Fox Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you. Thank you for tuning in. Big show planned for you. The remainder of the show, every show is a big show, but we got Sean Ross coming up 11:30, so make sure that you stay tuned for that. Big show planned for you tomorrow, just to give you a little teaser here. Todd Stacey, Alabama Daily News, you know him. He's on this station quite frequently. We also have a state majority leader, Nathaniel Ledbetter, going to come on. We're going to talk about teachers, getting kids back in school, and all the logistics involved with that. And Congressman Matt Gaetz from Florida's 1st Congressional District will be with us, and perhaps one other guest also I'm working on. So make sure that you tune in. Tomorrow ought to be a big program. We haven't talked about vaccinations. In our last discussion with Senator Sessions, David Sessions, we were talking about that is kind of the light at the end of the tunnel. All of this stuff you're having to do right now with masks, with social distancing, limiting occupancy, these are stopgap measures. They're not the solution. Even though they haven't told us what that solution is in Montgomery, they've dictated to us that you have to do these things. They're a must. This is what the CDC tells us. Well, why are we doing these things? And if we do these things, what is the goal? What are we trying to accomplish? It started out flattening the curve, not overwhelming the hospital system. It seems to me that it's since taken on a different objective. And it in some ways, it's just to eradicate coronavirus, to eradicate COVID-19, that we won't get back to normal till that goes away. But there's reason to be optimistic because everybody, all these so-called experts that we are told that know much more than you and I, they seem very optimistic about a vaccine. Alex Azar, he is the Health and Human Services Secretary, says it's very credible. We'll have millions of doses of gold standard vaccine by the end of the year. He says, quote, "We've seen under President Trump's leadership the most historic advances in the development of vaccines we've ever seen in human history. I guess it shows what we could do. We put our mind to it and put the resources and make them available. There's never been a vaccine for a coronavirus. So this is certainly a big development in science and in history for sure." And the way these guys talk, my guess is, just try to read between the lines here, they actually have something already. That they have something that's shown that it works. They tested it in clinicals on humans and animals. They have very promising results. So where they are now with it, they won't publicly announce it this way, but where they are now with it is figure how we're going to mass produce it and distribute it. And then you'll see probably first responders, essential personnel, the vulnerable, they'll be first in line for it, and then at some point it'll be made available to the public. Well, here's a question for you. Once it's made available to the public, are you going to have that? Are you going to go out and get that vaccine? So I know Sean Sullivan did a poll, online poll. It was like 70% or something said no. Well, let's add some qualifications here. What if your employer tells you have to, or you're not coming to work, or you need to go find another job? What they tell you, your kids can't come to school unless they have it. I mean, they do that in places, and then it becomes a situation where you have to have this. Does that change? That changes it, obviously, unless you got to give up on society. But we are in such a society right now where everyone is risk averse. Everyone wants to limit their liability. They don't want to take any chances. And you also have other costs, other concerns. You know, we have employer-based health insurance. Well, do you want to pose a risk to your employers? I mean, your employees, if you're an employer, of them getting COVID-19 and then have to pay those health costs indirectly or directly through your employer-based health insurance. It caused those premiums to go up. There's all these calculations are going to be involved. My guess is I don't think there will be some in government that will say we need to make this vaccine mandatory. There's always going to be people like that. And that's coming. And that's going to be the debate. And my guess is that's going to be the left of center position. Everybody has to have it. And we're going to mandate it. We're going to make you do it. You don't want to do it? Well, you have to do it. We made you wear a mask. We're going to make you do this. But there's already people saying, that's what Lieutenant Governor Ainsworth said when he said, well, this mask mandate, that signals to me that they're going to try to mandate a vaccine. And when he says they, he's referring to, I assume, Governor Ivey or whoever's governor when that time comes, when it's available, which it should be Governor Ivey. But that becomes the question, and it becomes a policy question, and it becomes a personal responsibility question. And we're going to be, my prediction to you guys is, we're going to be a society that's going to say, you're going to have to get the vaccine or you're just not going to be able to function in society. You're going to have to do this. Are you not coming to work here? You're going to go work somewhere else. Some of us have the luxury of being able to work from home. I work a lot from home. It becomes, for me, the personal decision. I'll probably get it. Why put my family at risk? Why put anybody else at risk that I'm around? I'll probably go get it. My fear is, and this is, I think, we're talking about the short-term implications of this. We don't know what the long-term implications are of a vaccine. What does that mean to your health? How do you feel about being the guinea pig that first go-around with this thing while they figure it out? Because it's a work in progress. How do you feel about that? That would be my biggest worry with this thing, with this vaccine, is that it's not going to be 100% ready to go, or it will be 100% ready to go, and it will check all the boxes that it is supposed to, but we don't know what the long-term implications are, what impact that has on the individual. Would this cause a virus to mutate? I'm not a scientist, but those would be my concerns. Those would be my questions, I think, before they mandate anything. Those are questions we got to know some answers to. It can't be like what we have now. We just have to wear masks. We just have to social distance. It's what the CDC tells us. Those are CDC guidelines. They know better. Do it. The CDC says, well, we must have the vaccine. Are we going to apply that same standard to what we're doing now? That's not going to be good enough. You're going to have to give people answers to these concerns, to these questions. You got to be transparent about it. Even if it means, we want to limit the liability for the business community. If that is a motivation, make sure you tell people that. You may not like it, but we have particularly in Alabama, we have such a government that caters to business in a way, and I get it, economic development, and that rise, it causes that rising tide that lifts all the boats, and it's good for the state. So you really want to make sure you take care of these guys because they employ a lot of people that can provide for their families, create economic activity. But at some point, are they going to say, well, we're going to do this, we're going to mandate this because this is what those guys want? They got to give us more information. That's all I am saying. My concern, and I don't know what other concerns you might have out there. You hear them. You hear them that it's some kind of, it's a scheme by George Soros and Bill Gates and Microsoft, and they just want to track you, and they're going to inject you with this the substance, and they're going to be able to track your movements and monitor you. I'm not a big believer. I've seen the inside of the belly of the beast. I was in Washington D.C. for a long time, and they could barely pass a budget. I don't have this assurance of their abilities to track every human being and do things in a way to. This nefarious, as some people may are alleging right now. Let's take a quick phone call. Let's talk to Gary in Gulf Shores. Let's talk about vaccines. Gary, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you guys doing today?
Doing well.
Look, you mentioned there might be some concern by some people on a mandated vaccination. I just don't think there will be, because we've had vaccination requirements many, many years, going back to polio and smallpox and TB, and there's still vaccination requirements now. State mandated vaccination requirements for before you can go to preschool or you know, elementary school and so forth. I think, you know, is deadly as this virus is, I think there'll be very little opposition to mandated vaccinations. I could be wrong. And hey, I'm an extreme conservative. I'm all for states' rights and independence and all that stuff. But I just don't think there will be the opposition some people may think.
Hey, thanks for the call, Gary. There's still this contingent of anti-vaxxers out there, even with the vaccinations that we have now. And a lot of them oppose it on the preservative, this thimerosal additive in these vaccinations that contains mercury, and that could contribute to birth defect or to defects or whatever, that it's bad for very, very young children. It causes problems. There's always going to be these anti-vaxxers out there, and I think they will show up in a big way in this debate. Mark my word, there will be a contingent of people that will oppose this vaccine and any mandates that come with it. And look, there's workarounds. Yes, you have to have a vaccination to go to some schools, but people might just keep their kids at home. That happens. It's going to be a debate. It's an interesting debate. And the merits of it, you know, I think people that approach this in an honorable fashion, they have their reasons. They're justified in having their reasons. But this is going to come down to how can we function without it? Because we can't function like things are right now. We can't function with this as the status quo. It's unsustainable. It's going to be very difficult to have businesses shut down, people wearing masks, and you know, doing the social distancing thing. We don't build buildings to keep 6 feet of separation from everybody. Maybe this is going to change the way we think. And you're going to make a usable space outdoors where it's less likely you could contract something like this. Maybe we don't have these big office spaces or these big buildings anymore, and you work from home. I mean, maybe that is a societal change. But I'll tell you what, the people that are skeptical of this vaccine, you know what that tells me? There's a mistrust out there. If you're not opposing it because you don't want your kid, there's health reasons, but you don't trust the people telling you that you need to have this, that they have the right intentions, there's a mistrust in our institutions. Why is that mistrust out there? Why don't people believe the media? Why don't people want to believe the governor when they say wearing them? Why? There's such a distrust out there. It's toxic. And I think if we want to be better, function better, and when the time comes that we're going to have a vaccination, and that we're going, you want people to believe you that you're going to do the right thing, then you got to build that trust back up. That's all there is to it. Because right now people are very skeptical of our leaders, of our institutions. And I think that is why you have these crazy numbers where 70% say they're not going to get the vaccine. Let's take one more call. We'll take a break after that. Eric in Fairhope wants to weigh in on vaccines. Eric, what's on your mind?
Hello?
Hey, Eric. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, man? You know, the clamoring about the vaccine just kind of drives me nuts for the simple fact that, you know, we had 60 people infected by the H1N1.
Did we lose you there, Eric? Yeah, I think we lost you. Try to call back in, 251-343-0106. We're going to take a, are we ready to go here? We're going to take a quick break. This is the Jeff Porsche Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Song of the South, sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth. Gone with the wind, there ain't nobody looking back again. Cotton on the roadside, cotton in the ditch. We all picked the cotton, but we never got rich.
A few gray feather olives say, could have had him any day. We only let him go so long, out of kindness, I suppose.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you on this Wednesday morning. Coming up in the next segment, you want to stay tuned for my good friend Sean Ross from Yellowhammer News, Editor-in-Chief there. We'll get caught up on some state politics. Where is that Tuberville, Doug Jones race, where he sees that headed, and some other things going on in you know, the state government realm of politics. So make sure that you stay tuned for that. Let's give it another shot here. Let's get Eric back on the line from Fairhope to talk about the vaccine. Eric, how are you?
Hey. Sorry about that. My point was, basically, 60 million people had the H1N1 infected. No vaccine, no pandemic. 4 million people get this virus, and everybody craps their pants. We shut the country down. You know, there's no doubt that this is political, without question. When I have State Department people and public health officials in my vehicle every few days, because I am a taxi driver, and it might sound like I'm just blowing smoke up people's rear ends, but when they say that it's cropping up again and they feel like people are putting the actual virus spores in areas for people to infect, you know, when this comes from people from the health department, you know, it really makes you worry about what's going on. So back home where I'm from, they're opening the schools. Football is starting at normal times. You know, here in the South, they're still freaking out and still listening to rhetoric that the Democrats are spooging all over.
Hey, Eric, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It is politicized. There's no question about it. Let's take your suggestion at face value. What if some nefarious government entity was putting the virus in the air, and they were targeting Alabama and other red states? It's all about politics. It's all about getting Joe Biden elected. Do they really think that's going to work? Do you really think you're going to take the most Trump state in the union and turn it blue? What is your goal here? Just to dispirit these states? I'm always skeptical of these big government, like, I don't know, conspiracy theories or what do you want to call them, because I'm just skeptical of big government's ability to do things. It's inept in a lot of ways. It doesn't function well. So, you know, we see Hollywood and this black helicopter sort of thing, and we think that's reality. A government, you know, it's not Burn Notice. It's not an episode of Burn Notice or whatever. It's not that cool. All you got to do is go spend some time. Next time you're in Washington, D.C., spend some time at some of these agencies that are these big, dark agencies that we think are all powerful. Go spend some time at them and just look at the people that work there. And it's not spy versus spy, I promise you. Government can do a lot of things. The military is very good at what it does. But these agencies, I am very skeptical of the conspiracies. Let's take another phone call before we get to a break here. Let's hear from Tony and Sims. Let's talk about the airport. Tony, what's on your mind? Go ahead, Tony. Did we lose Tony? Unfortunately, I think we lost Tony. Tony, give us a call back, 251-343-0106. The airport, we brought this up earlier, and the question I have, and some people have theories and given me answers, like, how did we wind up with Bates Field way out in West Mobile in the first place? Who thought that was a good idea? I'm sure they thought it was a good idea for good reason, that this was where the future of Mobile was going to be, out there. How did this happen? Why did it happen this way? Who made it happen this way?
Yeah, hi, this is Tony from Sims again. What do you have?
Hey, Tony, well, give it a shot.
Okay. I want to talk about the airport and Airport Boulevard, the two separate things, but you fly in the most major cities, and be it Chicago, New York, wherever, and you're not going to fly into Midtown or downtown. Fly 20-30 minutes away from the city.
Well, but that's a matter of space. They need big space, big runways for O'Hare, for New Orleans. They need these big runways so these big planes can come in and out of. That was always my perception of it, because you could fly into Chicago, you could fly into Midway. That's much closer to downtown.
How about Hartsfield?
Right.
Atlanta.
Well, but this was built. Now Atlanta's grown around it. But the reason you see these big airports way out of town is because you need longer runways and there's just not the space. It was never about that. But we have that. We had that luxury here with Brooklyn where you could get these bigger planes in and out of a of an airport. I think maybe that is part of it. But it wasn't like, hey, let's be like New York LaGuardia and put the airport way outside of downtown. No, there was there had to be a reason, and I think the reason was it purely was out of a goal of economic development. So anyway, we thank you for the call, Gary. But that's just the question to me. It's funny that we've gone full circle now, and now that we've gone from we want to go out of town and back to downtown, it seems to be kind of a trend nationally. Let's take a time out. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Right up over Spanish Fort into Mobile, my hometown. Mr. T. Sitting here at the Floribama, about to open up a big old can. Good time. Unwind.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. 35 minutes after the hour on this Wednesday morning. I got to get in that habit of saying morning and not afternoon. It feels like an afternoon. I've been up for so long. And Sean, who has been up much longer than I have, can certainly attest to that. But it is still morning, for at least here for another 25 minutes. Let's take a quick call before we go to our next guest. Let's hear from Gary. Gary in Mobile. What's on your mind? Go ahead, Gary.
Of like some kind of big government conspiracy. Are red states going to change to blue and blue states change to red? No, not at all. But it's that undecided voter, those swing states that the Democrats, the liberals are desperate for. And would have they come up with a virus if they knew it was going to help them out? I think so. But did they? No. It's not. They can't tie their own shoes without a staff of 200 people. So
right.
I mean, I agree with you there. They're not capable of such a conspiracy.
Hey, thank you for the call, Gary. Yeah, I just swing state, but the way that caller we had before you, he made it sound like they're doing it in Alabama for some reason. I don't know. Let's go to our next guest. Always a pleasure to introduce him. A longtime guest of mine, back to my Huntsville days, from Yellowhammer News. Sean Ross joins us. Sean, how are you?
Jeff, I'm good. Good to be on a show in South Alabama for you.
Yeah, so this ought to be a really cool feature here. Sean is the editor of Yellowhammer News, and we really talk. It's a very heavy segment on state politics, and we're gonna maintain that tradition going forward. Sean, first up, let's talk about the Senate race. 17-point morning consult poll came out yesterday. Do you feel that's probably about where it is right now with the Tuberville and Doug Jones?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the first thing people need to remember about this race is that we're in a presidential cycle, and ultimately there just aren't that many people who are going to go vote for Donald Trump for president and then vote for any Democrat for the United States Senate, or really anywhere down ballot. That's the main factor in this race. It's not going to change significantly, and this is a double-digit race.
I think it widens. I think it gets a bigger margin, and I'll say it like this: I think that the reason it was close when we did those polls that show these hypothetical head-to-head matchups back during the primary was at that time of that circular firing squad when all those candidates were beating up on one another. As that gets further and further away, more distant to the past, we're going to see that number maybe even grow.
That's right, and the main issues here is for Doug Jones, besides that he's a Democrat, aren't going away. He voted against Brett Kavanaugh. He voted to remove the president from office twice. He supported late-term abortion measures. You can go on down the list. He's not going to be a United States Senator come January 2021.
Right. And the goal, if you're Doug Jones, though, you got to figure out how to get voters to do that. And it's been done in the past. I mean, traditionally in Alabama, you voted Republican in presidential elections, but you voted Democrat down ballot. But I think since then, you've done this thing with the straight ticket voting. That makes it very difficult, even if you thought that was possible.
Absolutely, and I think if you look at really the nationalization of state politics, I mean, just look how far left the National Democratic Party has been dragged. That's hurting Doug Jones, too, and he really hasn't done, I think, what's necessary to separate himself from that either. You know, I mean, as we see these, you know, Trump presidential ads focus on law and order, you really just don't see Doug Jones doing anything to differentiate himself enough from, you know, really just the far left of his party. And that's what this race is going to become about. You know, Doug Jones is one of them, not one of us.
Yeah, because he didn't really take the Joe Manchin approach. He mm-hmm. didn't go vote against impeachment. Some of these votes he could have withstood, but here's the price. I think he really was trying to curry favor with the far left donor base more than just the far left. Had it been a different, you know, if they were a moderate voting base, he would have tried to curry favor with them, knowing that he has got a tough election ahead. And if he doesn't vote against Kavanaugh, if he doesn't vote for impeachment, if he doesn't take a tough stand toward against guns, and he doesn't, you know, talk about being pro-life, that money dries up. The Hollywood money dries up. The California money dries up, or wherever his donors are, and he has no shot at beating the Republican nominee in November.
That's right. We've talked about it. It's almost a catch-22. He's had to continue to really pander to and motivate that donor base with the things he's had to do to make them happy is ultimately going to make sure he has no chance in November. You know, he needed the money to be competitive, but how he's continued to get that money makes him less competitive. I don't really think there was ever a way he was going to win this election against anybody else but besides Roy Moore. You know, I think Roy Moore was just that special candidate, the only one that could somehow lose to Doug Jones. And you know what? At this point, Senator Jones is probably just hoping Joe Biden's going to win and Doug Jones is going to be Attorney General or something like that.
Yeah, because that was the speculation very early on. If y'all recall, Doug Jones was one of the very first public officials at that level, at the U.S. Senate level, which is a high level, to endorse Joe Biden. And what was, you know, what do we have, like 40-something people declare they were going to run for the Democratic nomination?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, I mean, Doug Jones has backed him on just about, you know, every little mini snafu of the Biden campaign. And he's a Biden loyalist. Obviously, he has the credentials to work in the Department of Justice or something related like that, something cabinet level. So that's his best shot for sure. And, you know, if these swing state polls are really anywhere near accurate, Trump's in trouble right now, especially if the economy doesn't recover quickly.
And that opens up the door for that potential cabinet appointment. Well, if you're Doug Jones, you're not fighting for your political. This isn't necessarily your do or die because you think you got that plan B, that option B. How far do you take it going up against Tuberville? How aggressive do you go, knowing that you could go too aggressive and eliminate your chance at a cabinet appointment?
Yeah, you know, I think everything Doug Jones does from now on, one eye has to be at what's happening on the national level. Can I help Joe Biden somehow with the ads I put out here? I wouldn't be surprised to see Doug Jones really spending a good amount of his money, not necessarily attacking just Tuberville, but attacking Trump. Obviously, look, Trump's going to route Joe Biden in Alabama, but Doug Jones has really, really kind of ramped up this online social media presence, and you see a lot of national momentum from the left when he puts stuff out. And I think that's the kind of campaign they're going to run. It's going to be a very national-focused campaign.
Joined by Sean Ross of Yellowhammer News here on FM Talk 106.5. Sean, let's get back closer to home, state politics. I guess more than a week or 2 weeks since that Department of Justice memo came out talking about all the violations, the Eighth Amendment violations with the prison, and the something better happen soon, or we'll send another memo out. I don't really know anymore what these Department of Justice edicts mean, but are you hearing any buzz? Are you hearing more movement in Montgomery about trying to do something to resolve that issue?
You know, not at all, Jeff, to be honest. The governor has her plan. She still thinks that, you know, she has us on track to remedy the situation. Hopefully that's true. I know a lot of legislators quietly want nothing to do with it. They want the governor to take all the responsibility for it, because if it fails, it's not on them. You have Democratic leaders like State Representative Chris England, who have a pretty big problem with the governor's route. I know State Senator Cam Ward, Republican, he's in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's really wanted the legislature to take a bigger role. But right now, there's just not enough of an appetite for that to actually happen. So the governor's moving forward on her construction plan. And I think next, probably regular session, next spring, they'll come back with some bipartisan measures. But yeah, right now, it's not like we're going to see a special session on this.
I don't think we're going to see a special session on anything, it seems. The governor is fearful of losing some of her executive power, or she doesn't know what the legislature might do if it were called into session. I to me, it seems like she's very, very reluctant to do anything, prisons or any of the economic development stuff, or even COVID-19, for the legislature to be back in session.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one big aspect of it. She's definitely not on the same page with Senate leadership right now. Still think there are some problems with the House that adds extra risk for her. But also just with COVID numbers continuing to be high in the state, there's no way she can justify calling the legislature back in. So unless the numbers go down, I would say there's 0% chance of special.
It occurs to me, though, you're not really hearing members of the legislature really wanting a special session either.
You know, there are a few of them who, you know, kind of have their pet priorities, but nothing you're really seeing any momentum behind.
Yeah, because if you had a few well-placed senior members or some leadership members saying, Governor Ivey, we need a special session to do this, it's imperative that we take care of this problem, be it prisons or be it, you know, and it looks to me like the budgets are, you know, they're sound, no fear of proration, that most everybody's okay with just letting it ride until 2021.
I think so. And, you know, for example, you had the leaders of the Senate, Del Marsh and Bobby Singleton, the leader from each party, respectively, and they wanted to do something for broadband in the special, but that's definitely not happening. I mean, they're not on the same page with the governor with how they want to do broadband, so I just don't see a special happening.
Does it have anything to do with kind of how the general session ended this year? The Senate was at odds with the House and the governor's office. That disagreement there, is it still kind of there? Still something that hasn't really fully resolved itself?
Oh, it definitely still is there. Yeah, that's the tension we're still seeing. And you know, technically, that the House agreed ultimately with the governor's proposal to end the session, but there are a lot of House members still upset with how that happened.
Well, it was amazing to me, though. They all vote, except for Chris Elliott down here in Baldwin County. Yeah. They all voted for that budget. They all went along. They could have forced her into a veto, but it's less about the whatever the policy and the legislation, more about just kind of the protocol and the decorum and the way it was handled.
Yeah, and you know, I think when you're looking at why they didn't try and do a veto, you know, it's mostly politics. You know, there was certainly a way the governor's office could have spun it that the legislature was blocking federal relief money from reaching Alabamians. So legislators were put in a pretty difficult spot there.
But the governor, on the other hand, she continues to rack up wins, even though she seems not to be as popular. She is scoring the W's.
I agree, and I think the question we need to start asking, Jeff, is she running for re-election?
Yeah.
It's getting close to that time, and, you know, she seems to be going full steam ahead relatively, so, I think that's the conversation we need to start having.
Yeah, and I guess when those feelers start to get out, that buzz tends to be generated. Hey, Sean, we're about out of time here. Before I let you go, tell folks where they can find you on social media, where they can read all the fantastic stuff at Yellowhammer News.
Thanks, Jeff. We're on yellowhammernews.com. You can find us in the App Store. I'm on Twitter, SEAN_YHN.
Hey, Sean, as always, thank you for making time for us.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Jeff.
That was Yellowhammer News' Sean Ross with us here. That is a question we got to start asking. Is Governor Ivey going to run again? Is she going to run for governor? Ainsworth seems to be gearing up for a gubernatorial bid. Also, who else might be out there to run for governor against Will Ainsworth? I mean, it's almost as if are we headed toward a potential Ivey Ainsworth matchup, or could it be Ainsworth and someone else? Well, these are questions you got to ask. I think it's getting close to that time. Like Sean said, I think you'll see a lot more movement after the November election. We got to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Out of pine size gold. A few gray federales say could have had him any day.
I can't get to sleep at night. The parking lot's so loud and bright. The AC hasn't worked in 20 years. Probably never made a single person cold. But I can't say the same for me. I've done it many times.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you. 54 minutes after the hour on this Wednesday morning. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we've got a big show for you. Todd Stacey from Alabama Daily News, he'll lead off in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, State House Majority Leader Nathaniel Ledbetter going to be on with us. We're going to talk to him about schools, getting schools back and going, and the concerns teachers may have. So you'll want to tune in for that. And then a big get for us tomorrow also, Congressman Matt Gaetz from Florida's 1st Congressional District. He'll be with us. I'm sure there's a lot to talk about there with Donald Trump, the convention. Trump this morning on Fox & Friends teased him as one of the speakers of his virtual Republican convention. But I know we have some listeners just across the Florida line there, so make sure that you tune in for Congressman Gaetz. Ought to be a good interview, assuming all goes well. So that's all tomorrow, just a little tease for you. So starting out the show talking about the $600 a week, and maybe I was underplaying it, but I don't think I was when I was trying to say that could you live off $600 a week. Well, this just said from the Doug Jones campaign. I got a statement here from Owen Kilmer, communications director for the campaign. Says, quote, Tommy Tuberville once again proves he's out of touch with Alabama. When he resigned from his job as football coach, he took a $5.1 million payout for himself. To this day, he receives $800 a week in state retirement funds for a coaching job he quote-unquote quit in 2008, and it goes on and continues. But he says $600 in emergency benefits is way too much for the people of Alabama who lost their jobs in this crisis through no fault of their own. Tuberville says $600 is way too much to help people put food on their table and pay utilities. And they finally finish up. No wonder when asked about to handle this crisis, he said, I wouldn't have a clue. It's true. He doesn't. $600, is that going to turn you to go vote Democrat now? That's kind of where I was headed with this. It's being used as a wedge and in a meaningful way. Is that $600 to some people? Is it as the Democrats say, going to make ends meet, going to help things out? And that's kind of where you're going with it. Does it matter that much in your life to a lot of people? Obviously, $600 is a lot of money. It does matter. It's going to help with the car payment, with the house payment, and things like that. But the way the Jones campaign is playing it, the way the Democrats are playing it, very interesting class warfare. He gets this, but you get this. And I don't think that appeals to Republicans so much as if you just do it this way. he's diminishing the value of $600 instead of saying, well, you know, $800 a week he gets in state retirement benefits. Well, he earned that. And also, he got a $5.1 million payout because Auburn University negotiated that with him. You're mad at anybody, it's Auburn University's fault. That's the deal we get these good quality football coaches to come in and give us winning programs. That's kind of how that works. Anyway, enough of that. Enough of me rambling. Going to call it a day here. As always, thank you for tuning in. We'll do it all again tomorrow at 9 a.m. This has been the Jeff Borst Show at FM Talk 106.5. This is